Hi, I'm Robert Osborne. Thanks so much for joining me for TCM's Private Screenings Uncut, a chance for you to listen to complete conversations from our TCM archives with guests who've appeared on our Private Screenings TV episodes. When we do a Private Screenings interview, I usually sit with a guest and talk for at least a couple of hours, but out of that, only an hour or less makes it to the air. So Private Screenings Uncut is a chance for you to hear the whole complete conversation. Now, this particular episode made some Private Screenings history because it was the first time I had one of these lengthy conversations with somebody who wasn't a classic film star. Instead, he's one of the most influential and enduring film directors in our midst, the great Sidney Lumet, a 5-time Academy Award nominee and the recipient of an honorary Oscar in 2005, which was presented to him in recognition of, and I quote, his brilliant services to the screenwriters, performers, and the art of the motion picture. In fact, when I sat down with Sidney for this interview in late 2004, the Academy had just announced he was going to be receiving that special Oscar. So we talked about that honor and what it meant to him. We talked also about his track record for directing other people into winning Oscars, and the one Oscar he didn't win, which was so disappointing to him, and why. But that's really just the tip of the iceberg concerning what we cover in this first part of our talk. We also get into Sidney's early career as an actor and why he gave up performing. We also discuss his early directing on live television and how he made the leap to the movies, earning his first Academy Award nomination as a director with his feature film directorial debut, 12 Angry Men. Sidney also reminisces about his working relationship with such notables as Henry Fonda, Sophia Loren, Katharine Hepburn, and Sean Connery. So here, originally recorded in December of 2004 and shown on TCM in October of 2005. Enjoy TCM Private Screenings Uncut, Sidney Lumet.
Well, I first have to say congratulations again on the Academy Award. I mean, that is so great.
Well, it's also
and so well deserved.
Thank you. It's also lovely because you're not competing against anybody. You know you've got it when you go in there.
Yes, exactly. How meaningful is it to you, actually? I know there's a lot of noise made when one receives an award like that, but does it mean a lot to you?
Enormous amount.
And why?
I think, you know, they talk about the politics of it and how powerful the studios are, and they try to force this through and that through. And I'm an example of the exact opposite. I'm not one of them. I've never lived out there. I think... How many pictures have I done, Robert? Because I don't know.
What?
It's over 40, I know.
Less, I would say right around 50.
Close to 50.
Yeah.
I've only done one out there. So I'm not a member of, quote-unquote, the community. I'm the total outsider. I know it caused a lot of resentment.
The New York, California thing?
Yeah.
Did that cause resentment, too, in, like, putting projects together? I mean, do you ever feel that you were... that they were somewhat prejudiced against you since you were kind of a New York director?
Well, you know, nothing ever interferes with Hollywood trying to make money.
Uh-huh.
So if my career was going well, if I'd had some hit pictures, nothing would interfere. As soon as I'd have a couple of flop pictures, it would interfere a lot. But it wasn't an inside thing. And that was what was so surprising about it. When Frank Pearson, who's the head of the Academy, called me, it was a big shock.
So well deserved. So well deserved. Now you've had 4 nominations as a director and 1 for a screenplay, and I believe 17 of your actors in your films have been nominated for Academy Awards, and 4 of them have won. Were you ever truly disappointed when you didn't win?
Once. Network, mm-hmm. which I think is a terrific movie.
It is a terrific movie.
And we took everything. Screenplay, 3 acting awards, 2 best performance and 1 supporting performance. And then I didn't win and we didn't get best picture. And I was furious. Rocky won. Boo!
Now let's go back a little in your life. You started out as an actor mm-hmm. from a theatrical family. Your father was an actor mm-hmm. in the Yiddish theater, and you became an actor at what age yourself?
5.
5. And did you like acting, or did that happen just because that was kind of a family tradition?
I have no idea whether I liked it or not. There was no chance to like it or dislike it. I was just thrown up there, and that was it.
Was that at all a painful period for you, being an actor?
No, I always used to say it kept me off the streets, you know. It was, and I don't think there's any limit on how young you can start to be exposed to creative life. At five, this was all in the Yiddish theater, first in Yiddish radio and then on the stage. But when I went to Broadway, which was when I was 11, I worked with great, great, great people. And I think that's a terrifically good way to spend time.
And the theater was different then. People made their living in the theater then. And the theater...
More or less, but the main thing is that a drama... could be put on for $8,000, and that was a fairly good budget. If it hit five figures, if you were in a play that had an $11,000 budget, you were in a big show.
Now, Ed, you were in Dead End, the great Dead End that we've all heard about and seen the movie version of, and co-starred in the movie One Third of a Nation with Sylvia Sidney. So, I mean, you were doing kind of important things.
I was working.
Yeah, indeed you were. Did you have the ego for that? That's required of an actor to pursue that?
I never thought of it that way, Robert. It was such a norm to me. You know, it's that old thing of, it doesn't matter if you're hit on the head five times a day. If that's what you're used to, that's the norm. And so that being in the theater, finishing a show at 11, 11:15, taking the subway back to Brooklyn alone, 11 years old, 12 years old.
But not so dangerous then.
No. And standing in the front of the subway, watching the tracks come at you, singing popular songs to yourself, nice way to make the time pass, and then getting off at Utica Avenue in Brooklyn, walking down the street, home 12 and 12:15. And the tough thing was, of course, getting up. I was going to public school then. So never enough sleep. But it seemed absolutely normal to me.
So why did you give that up, the acting?
I wondered about that. I was a good actor. I enlisted when I was 17, World War II. And when I got out, I went back to acting for a little while. And, you know, all good work is really self-revelation. And I think, for whatever reason... psychically, I got embarrassed at revealing that much of myself to strangers. Because if you're a good stage actor, eight times a week, here I am. Unzip me, that's it. And something about that must have been bothering me, because I started getting shy about it.
Have you ever had a desire to go back
None.
To it?
None.
Really? Mm-hmm. So we have so many directors today who... seem to act in films more than they direct now.
I was going.
But you've not been tempted.
No, Tom Fontana, who's wonderful. You know, he's a writer and producer of Oz, and he and Barry Levinson started doing another series about a jury, and they wanted me to play the judge, and I said yes, and then 2 days before they started shooting, I tripped on the sidewalk at night and smashed this whole side of my face. And so I couldn't go ahead.
Divine guidance,
yeah.
Then, saved you from that. Well, so you've never had a desire necessarily to go back to acting again. Mm-hmm. How did you get into directing? I mean, it's logical you'd stay somewhere in the theater, but why as a director?
Accident. You know, I think if you spoke to any number of people who've had any career at all, they would tell you how large a part luck played in it. And I was in the original actor studio, which was begun in 1949. And there were two classes, the beginner's class Kazan handled and the advanced class Robert Lewis handled. And
was that kind of an outgrowth of the group theater?
Yes, it was. And I had been with the group theater as a kid actor. I had done Saroyan's first play, My Heart's in the Highlands, when I was 14. And then gone away with the group to study. Whenever they had a successful season, they would take over a school somewhere, and all of them go away for the summer and work on various projects. So for the first studio experience in Bobby's class, Robert Lewis, this was, I felt was wasted time. We were basically working on realism. And as far as I was concerned, Americans were the best realistic actors in the world. And there were so many other styles that we couldn't do and didn't know anything about. And so at any rate, I spoke up and said I thought we were on the wrong course, and I got thrown out. And there were 13 other people who were also let go. And so I just took that as a nucleus and then invited about 20 more good actors that I knew and formed my own group downtown on University Place.
As a teacher? Or
we were just all together doing scenes.
Okay.
And also, I felt very, very, what was very important, which the studio wasn't doing at all, that we needed technical training. We needed voice. We needed diction, because I wanted to get into other styles of acting and a theater history. And we assembled a great group. Anthony Tudor gave us body movement. Marion Rich gave us voice and diction. It was terrific. And because there was nobody to direct the scenes, I started directing them. I had begun it, and I'd say, okay, well, why don't you move here, and why don't you move here? And things were working nicely, and literally fell into it. And even the professional beginning was an accident. Yul Brynner,
the King and I,
was a wonderful director. Television was just beginning then. This is 1950 or 51. And I had set up the drama course at High School of Performing Arts, which had just begun. And I was teaching there, and I think I was getting a fast $53 a week. And Yul called me one day. He said, "You're crazy." He says, "Come here. Nobody knows what the hell they're doing." And I went over to CBS and got hired.
As a director?
As an AD.
Uh-huh.
I was Yule's AD. And then when he left to do King and I took over his show.
You did? That was luck that you did fall into that.
Total luck.
So you were also very involved then in the early days of live television and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that must have been an incredible experience, looking back on it anyway.
Well, there are two aspects of it that are amazing. First of all, the thing that Yule said was absolutely true, which is nobody knew what they were doing. So there was nobody to say no.
Mm-hmm.
And in no time at all, in live television technique, when I did Iceman Cummis, I was using six cameras. It's live.
Mm.
And with the turret, four lenses on each camera, which was the second part of the television training, the visual end of it, even though it was a small screen, but when you went from a 28 to a 75, you knew the way that picture changed in its depth of field, not just its, not just the area that it was exposing. It was just the most marvelous training that could have been.
It was a great training ground for so many of you fellows that
and
went on to become.
And also, for instance, you were learning editing because you were editing as you were shooting.
Yeah.
So it was just irreplaceable.
And you had all those good New York actors to pick
from. Wow.
Yeah. Now, did you form a lot of strong friendships with other beginning directors back there at that point?
Robert Mulligan and I were hired the same day at CBS. There was a wonderful man in charge of CBS, and again, luck, by the name of Charlie Underhill, and he figured out that they could always teach us the technical end of it. And what he wanted were people who had been in the theater, who knew story and knew about acting. And so he tried to hire mostly those kinds of people, which is why Yul was working there, and he had hired Marty Ritt. He hired Bobby Mulligan. I was there. John Frankenheimer was my AD. He just created a chain of talent that was just wonderful.
Did you have any idea then that you were creating this whole new world? And
No. As our good friend Al Hirschfeld used to say, it's insanity. As a kid, when I went into a movie theater, a ticket was 11 cents, 1 cent of that being tax. I cannot, to this day, believe that a movie can gross $1 billion. That other than armaments, our second greatest factor in the balance of payments is entertainment. I mean, that we are the kind of economic force that we are in this country is inconceivable to me. And the same thing about what was going on in television and what television meant and what it would become. No idea.
So then came movies. Your first movie was 12 Angry Men, mm-hmm. which came out in 1957, which was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture and Sidney Lumet for Best Director for his first film, which is amazing. How did that come about? How did you make that transition into film?
Again, luck. I had done Reggie Rose's first television show. I was doing a melodrama.
The Writer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was doing a melodrama show called Danger, a half-hour show on Tuesday nights. And
was that live?
Live.
Uh-huh.
And read a script of Reggie's. We put it on, and then he wrote for us then steadily. And 12 Angry Men had been done at NBC. I was under contract to CBS. And when it was picked up as a movie, he asked me to do it. And Henry Fonda was the producer. And again,
I think the first film he ever produced.
Yeah.
Wasn't it? Maybe the only one.
Yeah. And then the extraordinary luck of it. When I had this workshop every year, at the end of the season, we would do a full play, an original play. Two of the members of the workshop were in Mr. Roberts. And so at the end of one of the seasons at the workshop, Fonda came down to see the production. And the following year, when Reggie proposed me to direct 12 Angry Men, Fonda said, oh, I saw a workshop thing he did. It was terrific. Yeah, fine. Bang. I didn't have to audition for it. I didn't have to talk to anybody for it. It just fell into my lap.
How was Fonda to work with? Here you have a major, major star working with a first-time movie director, somebody he's given the approval to. But how was he to work with and to direct?
He was wonderful and terrifying at the same time.
Terrifying to you?
To me.
Uh-huh.
The very fact that I rehearsed immediately made him fall in love, because he was a stage actor, you know. And here, clearly with a whole movie taking place in one set, rehearsals were easy because it was a question of blocking it and so on. I rehearsed a little over 2 weeks.
Sort of became a norm for you.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't it?
Yeah.
So you rehearsed before you
shoot. But
that
was my background, Rob, because I'd rehearsed, obviously, in live television and rehearsed in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know how to work without it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and this was a side of him that I didn't know at all, as we got near shooting, 2 days before we started shooting, I said to him, Hank, you want to come down and see the set? And he said, yeah, let's go. And rehearsals had been wonderful. And we walked onto the set, and you have, in most interior sets, a backdrop. In other words, what you see outside the window, buildings, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we had no money on 12 Angry Men. The picture, Robert, you're not going to believe this. We did it for $349,000.
Amazing. And what, like, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something
19 days.
19 days.
And the backdrop, was painted. It wasn't a photographic backdrop. It was painted because, not having the money, we wanted to be able to use it for both day outside the window and night, just by lighting it differently.
Uh-huh.
And because they're very expensive to make. And Hank walked onto the set, and he went pale. He had just finished working with Hitchcock. And Hitchcock, at that time, was one of Hollywood's most successful directors. And there were almost tears in his eyes. He said, look at that backdrop. This is terrible. It looks like junk. You will never get away with it. I just finished with Hitchcock. His backdrops, you could walk into them. They were so real. And he was quite right. But fortunately, I had a great, great cameraman, the magnificent Boris Kaufman. And Boris said, don't worry about it, I can make it work. But a kind of terrified petulance came out of him. Mm. And it was so different than the Fonda I knew from rehearsal, where he was just an actor and full of joy at the process and working with the other actors. And all of a sudden here, I guess he was scared also because it was the first time he had produced.
Mm-hmm.
And then also subsequently, within a day or two, I found out another thing, which is that he was so shy, he never saw his movies until 2 years after he'd made them, if then.
Really?
Yep. And here he was the producer of 12 Angry Men, and he had to come to Rush's.
Uh-huh.
And he'd better come to Rush's. He's got a first-time director. God knows what I'm going to do up there. And he came the first day, and he sat right behind me. And there were four or five shots before he was included. The only thing he was included in was a dollying shot of the jury. But otherwise, there was the boy on the stand and the judge and setting up various characters. And as it came to his close-up, he leaned forward, squeezed my shoulder, said, "It's brilliant," and ran out and never came again.
Really?
Yeah. That uncomfortable at looking at himself. And then, as you know, we did four or five more pictures together.
Yeah.
A brilliant, brilliant actor. Brilliant.
Now, it's such a good movie, and it's still become one of the great classic films. It didn't do well financially, though, did it?
It did not. What happened was that it, even with the nominations, distributing a picture like 12 Angry Men in those days was unknown. It fell into the category to them of a European art house movie. And for our sins, we opened at Easter at the Capitol. Now, the Capitol was on 51st.
Big
Broadway,
big
enormous
Broadway Palace
with I think it sat like 4,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
It had a stage show. I don't know whose band was playing, and not quite the release that the picture should have had.
Uh-huh.
Wonderful reviews, and we were out of there in 2.5 weeks because the nut what it cost to run that theater. We couldn't we just weren't earning even the nut.
Do you think that discouraged Fonda from then producing again?
It might have.
Uh-huh.
It might have. And then, of course, these accolades kept coming in from Europe. And won the Berlin Festival, and we started doing great business in Europe. We ran in Paris for 14 months or something like that.
What's such a great film?
And so that might have changed his mind, but he did not produce again.
Then your next film was with Fonda again, Stage Struck.
Stage Struck.
Filmed in New York. Mm-hmm. Kind of the beginning of the liaison between Sidney Lumet and New York, mm-hmm. as a filmmaker, certainly. Remake of Morning Glory, the
right.
Katharine Hepburn film.
Right.
And really an ode to the theater. I love that film because it's such a great picture postcard as well of New York in the late 50s.
Right.
And what it looked like.
I love it for just that one shot of them riding in the taxi, reading the reviews, going up Times Square, and it's raining outside, you know. It's an amazing shot. It was really my Valentine to the theater.
Is it difficult remaking a film that had quite a bit of success when it first came out?
I'll tell you what happens, Robert. In no time at all, your ego gets so enormous, you never think about that.
Ah.
I had no hesitation whatsoever. I must say, when I did The Wiz a lot of years later, a little trepidation, also a little bit of knowledge had crept into me. I'd had my ears pinned back a number of times. But at that time, no, it never occurred to me.
And again, you had a wonderful cast with, I believe it was Christopher Plummer's first film,
right.
And Susan Strasberg had just had her huge success in Diary of Anne Frank.
Right.
Playing the Katharine Hepburn part.
Right.
Joan Greenwood. I mean,
right.
Wonderful cast.
Right.
Really
right.
Great.
Herbert Marshall,
yeah. Now, after that, you did a film that I've liked very much, but I know it wasn't one of your favorites, I don't think. That Kind of Woman with Sophia Loren.
It's a picture that the first 45 minutes of that movie are wonderful.
Yeah.
The rest of it is, it was taken from a short story in The New Yorker. Walter Bernstein did the script and did a wonderful job. The dialogue was so alive. Jack Warden is sensational in it. But it was corny. It was really a very corny story. As I say, I thought the first 45 minutes on the train were lovely movie making.
But that was a big studio project, Paramount. Pictures. Mm-hmm. And didn't they sort of take the editing away from you?
They did. They did. Carlo Ponti produced. Also, it was not a picture that they wanted to make in New York. But Sophia wanted me to direct very badly, so I wanted to stay here, and so it was done here.
And we all love Sophia. How was she to work with?
What does the word heaven mean to you?
She's
the most glorious, warm, funny, magical personality. A little sexy, too.
Yeah, a little, a little. I'd say. Yes.
Just a joy to be around, and everyone was in love with her.
Well, that's one of those films that you don't see much these days that I always like people to have a look at. Because
I don't even know if it's
gotta
on
be
tape.
Around. It has to be around somewhere. No. I don't know if it's available for sale, but it has to be around. Always reminded me a little of The Shopworn Angel with Margaret Sullivan and Jimmy Stewart about the...
How right you are.
The worldly woman with the kind of shy young soldier.
You're absolutely right, Robert. Never occurred to me. You're right.
Sophia and Tab Hunter.
Right.
Interesting combination. Now, after that came The Fugitive Kind, based on Tennessee Williams' Orpheus Descending,
right,
with three dynamite people. You have Marlon Brando, Anna Mignani, and Joanne Woodward.
Right.
And adapted from a stage play, which is something you've done a lot, adapting from a stage play. First off, is that process difficult? I mean, when you're somewhat confined by what's been written on the stage to try to open it up in film without losing the essence?
I don't feel that, Robert. I think one of the mistakes that are made, that one of the reasons that there are so many movies that are not good that are made from stage plays is because people try to, quote-unquote, open it up. I've never worried about that. I don't see why, since it's a face that I'm interested in, I don't see why it's less of a movie if it's against a wall as against a mountain. The fact that it's going outdoors doesn't make it a movie to me. A movie is about revelation in human behavior, and your technical expertise in not letting it sink into visual dullness is the answer to that. Do that rather than opening it up. So on Fugitive Kind, I guess there must have been 60 pages. Half of that script took place in the store. And yet visually it's a rather enthralling movie.
When you think of it, a lot of your films have been in somewhat enclosed quarters.
Yeah, largely because I'm not afraid of them.
12 Angry Men, certainly. Fugitive Kind, Murder on the Orient Express,
right,
etc. Let's talk a little about Marlon Brando. What was he like to work with? Certainly a force of nature up on the screen.
And a force of nature in a room, and a force of nature as an actor. A great actor. That's not a word I use lightly, nor do I mean it in the variety sense of it. I mean it in the total sense of it. A wonderful man. Brilliant man. Who knows everything, not out of intellect, not out of education, but an instinct that just encompasses everything. Knows everything you're feeling, I'm feeling, the man in the moon, who he's working with, coupled with an almost psychotic concentration. When Marlon zeroes in on something, his acting concentration locks in, and it's unbreakable. And a total joy. Thrilling actor, thrilling person. And I thought it was a thrilling performance. I think the opening of that movie, when he's brought up before a judge, and you never see the judge, the camera just stays with Marlon, is one of the best pieces of acting on the screen that I've ever seen.
He always had such a reputation for being difficult, and he may have been in his personal life, but he was not on a film set.
not on my film set. We knew each other a little before the picture from when he was an actor in New York, but I worked with a number of people who had difficult reputations. Hepburn had a difficult reputation. James Mason had a difficult reputation.
Really? Didn't know that.
Testy.
Mm.
The thing that I found, and I'm not saying this in a self-flattering way, was that basically that I found with those people, they are marvelous at their work. They know themselves, they know their work, they know their job from a technical sense. And they want whoever they're working with to know theirs. Marlon did something that's basically unfair. He has no right to do it. But I understood completely why he did it. He would, and I know he did this on two other pictures, he would basically test the director. He'd give you two takes. In one of them, he'd be working really fully. By that I mean on an internal level. And the other one, in which the outside form would be identical, but he'd be doing nothing inside. And he'd watch and see which one you printed.
Mm.
And if you printed the wrong one, you'd had it. He wasn't going to pour out his guts for somebody who couldn't see it or appreciate it. He didn't want a director who was in love with him and loved everything he did. He didn't want to expose himself. Because, as I said earlier, you know, all good acting, all good work is self-revelation. And it's very painful to do that for someone who is going to be the final judge of what goes into the film, but doesn't understand you and doesn't see what you are doing.
But also, you being an actor would make you more sensitive to that, I think, than most people.
Exactly. Very helpful.
And them, perhaps, they would be more responsive to you knowing that you'd been an actor as well.
As long as they saw that I hadn't killed off that vulnerable part of myself, yeah.
Now, The Fugitive Kind has Marlon Brando, Joanne Woodward. They both came from kind of the same background.
Right.
And all of that. But into that, you've got this other force of nature from Italy, Anna Magnani,
right,
who I assumed worked in a totally different manner. How did that mesh, or what did you have to do to make that mesh together?
I don't think I ever succeeded, Robert. I think that's why it's not a really marvelous picture. I think it's
really
a picture with wonderful stuff in it and very interesting. But I don't think it's a successful picture from my point of view. I don't think I ever did get that integration. Magnani, for instance, about rehearsals.
Now, she'd never done a stage play, to my knowledge, had she?
Well, she had.
Oh, she had.
She just said she hadn't.
Ah.
And she had been in the theater in Italy. And yet when she came here and we began rehearsal, Sydney, I can't rehearsal. I don't understand this rehearsal. Kill everything spontaneous, which is, by the way, totally untrue. The fact is that you're twice as spontaneous when you've got a base to the performance, when you know what you're doing,
mm-hmm,
because then the fear stops,
mm-hmm,
and you're open to whatever happens.
Mm-hmm.
She just didn't want to reveal to Marlon or to any other actor what she was going to do with anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what it was about.
Ah.
So after the third day of rehearsal, I just stopped rehearsing. And I said, well, we might as well start shooting because I'm not going to get anything from her until we do start shooting. So, and she said that she had never been in the theater, that she'd never rehearsed. She didn't know what the procedure was. But I subsequently found out from Tennessee that she had.
Tennessee Williams, who wrote it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, was she having trouble with Italian or with English language?
Horrible trouble.
At that
horrible
point?
Horrible. It's another thing that injured the picture so badly. She, you know, I don't know if I'm right on this, Robert, but I think that learning languages are largely psychological. if you dislike a place, you're never going to learn the language. You're going to resist it. I think she hated being in America. And so she never really learned English. In fact, once I had previewed the picture, I had to bring her back from Rome, and we had to loop 80% of it because she was almost incomprehensible in many scenes. So it's her performance and my inability to get her toward the area that I wanted that, for me, leaves the picture incomplete. Joanne was superb, poignant, vulnerable, and deeply true in terms of that character. And I think her scenes with Marlon are not only the best in the movies, in the movie, just among the best in movies. Extraordinary what happened between the two of them.
And she's one of the ones that championed you for the Academy Award, I understand.
Yeah.
She and her husband?
She sure did.
Now, your next film after that was View from a Bridge, From the Bridge, which was also a stage play, mm-hmm. adapted to a movie, again with a European star in the male lead.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a conscious choice that you made? Because that was one of those great roles that any number of American actors, I'm sure, would have
given
loved
his
to
eye teeth
done.
For.
Yes. Ralph Alone played it.
And the financing for the movie came from a French producer. And Ralph had made this enormous hit of the play in Paris.
Uh-huh.
So he was attached to it before I was.
I see.
The producer hired him, raised the money on the basis of him, and then they came to me. I had seen him play it in Paris, and he was wonderful. So off we went.
Now, after that came another stage play, Long Day's Journey Into Night, which I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you didn't actually have a screenplay written for. You did the play.
We did the play. I cut the text of the play, or at least in the copy I had, is 177 pages. I cut 7 pages because in a movie it's possible to make things clearer sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think O'Neill is repetitive. I think he's like a magnificent awl that just keeps going around and biting deeper and deeper into the wood. Goes over the same thing again, but that each time he goes around it, you're getting more into the core of what's really going on.
So here you have a Eugene O'Neill play. You've got Katharine Hepburn, Ralph Richardson, Jason Robards, and Dean Stockwell. Now that's some cast. And you shot that, I believe, in a real house, didn't you?
No, we built
it.
Oh, I'm
sorry.
We built it in a studio. A tiny studio on 21st Street.
Again, confined quarters.
Yeah, yeah.
And what was Katharine Hepburn like to work with? You said earlier that she was a dream, but was she complicated at all?
Well, how do you talk about somebody you're in love with? It could not have begun more terribly. I went out to California to see her. I wanted her. She was the only one I wanted for the part. And the picture was produced by a terrific guy by the name of Eli Landau, who had made his money in trucking and had something that made him want to be in movies, and preferably art movies with a capital A. And we went out to California. He asked me who I wanted, and I wanted Kate. And she was living in John Barrymore's house in California, which was built like a bowling alley. It was about 60 feet long, the living room, and about 20 feet wide. Very peculiar thing. But he always lived in peculiar places. And I walk in, and she's at one end of the room, and I'm 60 feet away. We start walking toward each other, and I've got my hand out. And when we're about 25 feet away, no how do you do, no hello, no nothing. When do you want to start rehearsal? September 19th, Miss Hepburn. I can't start till the 26th. Why? Because then you'd know the play better than I do. So, now, hello, I'm Sydney. You know, now we shake hands. and we chat. And we leave, and Eli said, well, that didn't go very well. And I said, no, it didn't. And but he said, well, we can go get anybody you want. It's a part that any actress would die for. I said, no, it's got to be her, because it's about a giant tree falling. And I need a giant to play that, and she's a giant. And I said, I don't know what'll happen, but let's go with Kate. And so we did. And I rehearsed 3 weeks on that, because the people are so complicated, and there was so much to learn. I knew it would be a very long movie. And I have never been so thrilled in the rehearsal process and in the making of the movie as I was with that. What happened to Hepburn during the rehearsal, and the way she, her great, great, great acting good sense. You know, you can have good sense, but if it's not acting good sense, it doesn't help you. One day, I was blocking the third act, and Edmund has a line. She's three quarters of the way into her total addiction, totally high, and revolving around the room and won't stop and isn't listening to him. And finally, he grabs her and he says, Mama, I've got consumption, which he's been trying to tell her now all day long. And the word consumption meaning TB in those days. And she stopped, and I said, Kate, this is during rehearsal. When it gets through to you, take whatever time you need for the word to penetrate. But when you've heard it, I want you to haul off and whack him as hard as you can. And she said, Sydney, I could never, when it... stopped. She said, let me try it. The first reaction was just on a human level of after a piece of news like that, and then wait a minute, this character, this day, the disasters that are falling in on her, and also the most human thing, what does a mother do when a kid just missed getting hit by a truck? Come here, never do that again. Uh-huh. You know, it was just on every level, it was... a good choice. And it, just the way she took it in after the initial reaction being, and then, oh, wait a minute, the acting sense took over. Another remarkable incident with her. Very often, unless I've got a lunatic in the cast, I invite the actors to rushes. I've got no secrets. Some actors can look at themselves, some actors can't, like Fonda. Breaks up about 50-50. And so we were talking at the end of rehearsals, and I said, Kate, where do you want your dressing room? You want it on the set, you want it as far away from the set as possible, and for all of the actors. And then I said, and by the way, this is just the day before we're going to start shooting, and I said, by the way, you're all welcome to rushes. And then we broke up, and we're leaving, and she said, called me over, and she said, Sydney, you know, she said, I've gone to the rushes of every movie I've ever been in. Which doesn't surprise me, because she knows a lot. And she said, I won't be coming to these. And I said, Kate, I've got no secrets. You're welcome. And she said, no, I know Boris's work. Boris Kaufman was the cameraman, great cameraman. And I know your work. And I know you're going to be honest in this movie. And if I go to the rushes, all I'll see is this and this. And I just need all of my strength to play the part. And I'll tell you, Robert, I almost wept. First of all, the dedication to her work that represents.
And the smarts, too. See, wow.
And the acting sense. The trust that she was exhibiting in Boris and myself, the the wisdom and the selflessness of it. She was saying, look, if you have to photograph me so that I'm lying in a pool of vomit, that's what it is. That's what I took on when I took on this part. The selflessness of it takes a great actress and a great person. There are great actresses who could never do that or say that. So what can I tell you? We didn't see each other often. 20 years later, you remember those Nights of 1001 Stars at Radio City Musical?
Alexander Cohen.
That's the one. And I was going to be on it, and so was Kate. And we a rehearsal, and there we go, except now the distance was 120 feet. I come into onto the stage at Radio City Musical. She's sitting all the way over there, and I start running toward her. She can't get up. She's busted her ankle. And I run to her, and we kiss, and we picked up the conversation exactly where we'd left it off 20 years earlier.
Great.
The best.
And she received an Oscar nomination, I think, her ninth nomination for that film.
Right.
One of her great performances, certainly.
I think so.
Yeah. And then came a little number called The Pawnbroker. Great film. Certainly one of my favorites of all films. It's also one of the first films ever done about the effects of the Holocaust.
I think so.
We've had a lot
of the first American films.
Yeah.
Maybe even European.
Was that a conscious decision to do a
story on that
subject?
It was on my part. It was on my part. Another director had been assigned to it. He was not a New York director. And Eli Landau was financing that. He had done Long Day's Journey and Tonight. And they were like 4 weeks from shooting, and no locations had been picked. And it was a bit of an organizational mess. And Eli asked me to come in. I read it. Wanted very much to do it. And went to work. Very hard picture to do on many levels, emotionally, physically very tough. So I was shooting around Harlem a lot. And it was interesting. There was a very delicate scene between Rod Steiger and Geraldine Fitzgerald taking place in a park. And I thought, oh God, we've got to finish by 3 o'clock because there's a high school right down the block and that's all I need. 800 high school kids let loose at 3 while I've got this delicate scene to do. I cannot tell you, Robert, how extraordinary the civilian population was. And it's something that I think almost every director will tell you, how in poor districts it's much easier to shoot in terms of the way people respond to you than it is in sort of middle class district, because you're inconveniencing people in middle class districts. Your cables are running across the entrance to their door or their garage or what have you. In poor districts, you're giving them something to look at and think of and participate in, because their lives are not that terrific. And maybe that's the reason. I don't know.
Interesting.
But those kids came out of school, and the assistant director called up, would you please be quiet? We're shooting with sound, so no noise, please. It was as quiet as a studio. They were just wonderful. And another picture subsequently where I was shooting in a total middle-class district, and bottles were coming off the roof.
Mm. Again, in Pawnbroker, you were working with a lot of wonderful New York actors in the supporting parts. That's sort of a kind of a theme, not a theme, but a regular thing in a Sidney Lumet film, or all these wonderful New York actors that you work with.
Well, the interesting thing, Robert, is that it's one of the reasons I want to work here, because the talent supply is endless. I mean, it's true even now. What am I, 50 years later or something, 40 pictures later, still finding the reservoir of talent constant. It's amazing. There's also, and this affected Pawnbroker, particularly affected Dog Day Afternoon. There's also another value here, as far as actors are concerned. You know, in on the coast, there is something called the Screen Extras Guild.
Right.
And people go out there to make their living and spend their life being an extra in a movie. And they come in with a little hat that makes them look like Minnie Pearl.
They have to supply their own clothes.
Yeah,
I believe, don't they?
So they come in looking like Minnie Pearl. You get $2 a day extra if it's your own tuxedo kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But that's their life. And in New York, there is no such thing. Your extras are Screen Actors Guild members. And any number of them will be appearing off-Broadway while they're shooting the movie. They're actors. And if you bump one of them up to by giving them lines and to a higher pay scale and so forth, you'll have an actor that you're dealing with, not somebody from Dubuque who came out, as I say, with a Minnie Pearl hat. So on something like The Pawnbroker, it was terribly important that the people in the street, the actors, extras, be no different than the other people that I was photographing all the time who were falling into the background of shots.
And such interesting faces, and faces that you don't see a lot in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
That pool from New York, the actors.
Right.
Now, Quincy Jones did the music for The Pawnbroker.
It was his first score.
First score. Where did you get the idea to use him? And along that same line, at what point do you usually think of music for your film? Is the film done and you think of it, or do you kind of get the guy involved early on?
Most of the time, I have an idea of whether I'm going to use a score at all, and I've done like five pictures without any score. Dog Day Afternoon doesn't have one. Network doesn't have a score. It's usually part of the concept of the whole movie. And then you start thinking about who to use, because you are casting a composer the same way that you cast an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Are they right for the movie? I knew that I wanted a jazz score mixed with European elements. That in essence, and this was something I had thought of from the beginning, that in essence the conflict between Saul, the Rod Steiger part, old world European sound versus the sound of Jaime, of the kid. And so I approached John Lewis of Modern Jazz Quartet first. And they came to see the movie and didn't like it.
Hmm.
So that fell out. Then there was something then, Robert, called third stream jazz, which was using jazz instruments, jazz arrangements, jazz rhythms, but in classical, composed in classical ways. Quintets, quartets, written down, no improvisation here, octets, full orchestras. And there was a wonderful arranger in that by the name of Gil Evans. And I approached him next. And he was very busy. And the whole idea of doing a movie seemed ridiculous to him. And also, by the way, he was very right about one thing. He knew that scoring a movie doesn't belong to the composer. That in a sense, it really also belongs to the director.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said no. And then I'd kept hearing about this young trumpeter, Quincy Jones, who had just come back from Sweden, where he had toured with his own band. And I thought, and I got hold of some of the records that he'd made in Sweden, and played a couple. There were a lot of standards there, but a couple had his own composition. And I went to meet him, and he was as beautiful a person as I've ever seen. But that's both externally and internally. Incredible-looking man, and the gentlest, sweetest, most intelligent. And he saw the movie and flipped, and we went to work.
Fascinating. Now, after that came a most interesting movie, Failsafe, which again is one of those films, a little like 12 Angry Men, again with Henry Fonda, that was a great critical success that people loved and is today a classic, but didn't do all that well at the box office. But there is a story behind that.
There is a story behind
that. So what happened? Why wasn't it seen by more people?
The picture originally was produced and financed by a marvelous man by the name of Max Youngstein, who used to, in effect, run United Artists. He ran United Artists during the great days.
Mm-hmm.
And Max went out and raised $950,000, which is what it cost. As you can see, I'm no great believer in big budgets. And all of a sudden, 3 weeks before we were to start shooting, a lawsuit landed on us on a charge of plagiarism. And the lawsuit was brought by, not against us, but against the authors of the original book. Two professors, I've forgotten their names. Eugene Burdick was one name, and I've forgotten the name of the other. It was brought by Stanley Kubrick, who was doing Dr. Strangelove at the time. The lawsuit alleged that the two professors had stolen the hook, line, and sinker, the plot of an English novel, I don't remember what the what that was called, and had written a book called Failsafe, which totally plagiarized the book. It turned out that the two plots were very similar. I'd never obviously read the English book. And the upshot of it, the way the lawsuit was settled, was that Columbia Pictures took over both.
So at this point, had you started making Failsafe?
Yes.
That Columbia took it over.
And Columbia took it over. They were releasing both pictures. There was a very nice man at the head of Columbia then by the name of Jaffe.
Leo Jaffe.
Leo Jaffe. Mm-hmm. And when we finished the picture, I was told that Kubrick's movie was going to come out first, Dr. Strangelove.
So the comedy would come out before the
drama.
Dramatic version.
And I went to Leo and I said, Leo, you've got it backwards. If that picture is as good as I hear it is, I hadn't seen it then, but I hear it's wildly comedic, so release us first, then the takeoff, and you might have a hit out of both pictures. But I don't know whether Stanley controlled it or whether it was a Columbia Pictures decision. I don't know who made the final decision. At any rate, they did it the other way, which, of course, killed us off because you can't take it seriously after you've seen Peter Sellers do us.
Yeah, but it's certainly been hailed and without the competition of Dr. Strangelove now when people see it. I mean, it's one of the great films.
Oh, thank you.
And Fonda is wonderful in it again.
Yeah.
That was your third, I believe, with Fonda. Mm-hmm. And then came The Hill, which I think is such an interesting film. And I believe, wasn't it like Sean Connery's first big movie after the James Bond?
It was. It was his first part as another character, you know, his first leading part as another character.
First chance to see him not being James Bond.
Right. It's interesting about parts like James Bond or Sean playing James Bond. You see all this lightness, you see all this charm, you see this persona at work. Cary Grant's a perfect example of somebody who made a career out of playing a certain kind of charming person. Doing that is very tough acting. Most directors and most actors know that that's real acting. that it's not just a question of being charming. In fact, charming is the one thing you cannot give an actor. No director is going to help anybody be charming. Mm. They either have it or they don't. But it is acting. It really is the essence of light comedy. And so I knew when I was sent that script and that Sean was attached to it, and I knew that that he could act. And everybody else was very surprised. And then this lifelong friend and co-worker.
Yes, you've made many films with him since.
We've done five movies together.
Yeah. Now, he was, I believe, somewhat instrumental in getting the whole project made, right?
Oh,
early on.
It wouldn't have happened without him.
Mm-hmm.
He was at that time one of the biggest box office stars, still is, I guess. And he was the 5,000-pound gorilla.
Right.
If Sean wanted to do it, it got
made. And difficult to make, because wasn't that shot in Spain and very, very warm weather?
Not warm weather, Robert. Hot weather, like of a heat that I've never known. And what was so insane, this desert area is in Spain. Lawrence of Arabia was shot there.
Right.
The funny thing is that right over the last dune is the Mediterranean Sea. And you've got this sea breeze coming up off the Mediterranean. So as you're pouring buckets of sweat, it's being dried off you immediately. It's evaporating. And there's no water left in your body. And about the fourth day, I turned to Sean. I said, Sean, are you peeing at all? And he said, only in the morning. I said, me too, only in the morning. And of course, what was happening was that the water was evaporating all day, and it took 8 hours of sleep for enough water to accumulate in your body so that you'd have to urinate. It was physically as daunting a movie as I've ever tried. And those guys went up that hill, and it was a killer. It was a murder.
Give up the hill, and then again, and then again, and again.
There's one shot where they do it three and a half times. And literally, the only two people who made it were Sean and Jack, a big Scotsman. Forgotten his second name. We're the only two. Everybody else collapsed at one point or another.
That's another great film. Sold strangely, though. Didn't you have a bit of a problem with that? About
a nightmare in the distribution of it. What happens with companies, even though they recognize that it's a different kind of picture, and that really their hope lies in selling the difference, they always get scared of that. So that, for example, again, it was a very inexpensive movie, barely over $1 million. And there was a wonderful theater, an art house in London, that played always the best art pictures. The reason it was so good was because it had very low running expense, so that we could have gone in there and stayed for 6 months, which would have been the way to do it. Because it involved Sean, this gigantic star, we found ourselves opening at the Odeon Leicester Square, which is London's equivalent of Radio City Music Hall, at Christmas. We were there 8 days or something and replaced. Because the audience is going to the Odeon Leicester Square. We're not ready to see Sean playing that kind of a part.
Right.
And that, of course, destroys the distribution for the rest of the world.
Right. Because usually, I believe, didn't the James Bond films open around Christmas time in big
always
theaters?
Always at Christmas, and always in the Odeon Leicester
Square. Right, yeah. Well, that's another one that has a great lifespan. You have such an interesting filmology because you never quite know what you're going to do next. I mean, your films don't have big budgets, and you resisted certainly the widescreen era of doing that kind of film. But your films are all so different, with different values and different interesting people and different settings. And your next one after this was like a totally different kind of Sidney Lumet movie, and that's The Group.
Oh, really?
With all
that came after The Hill?
Yeah, right after The Hill.
Son of a gun.
So, and there you are with all these interesting new actresses that most of us hadn't seen before, and interesting book about women. So talk a little about that, how you got interested in that or attracted to that property. It was a very popular book by
big seller.
Mary McCarthy.
Mary McCarthy. A man by the name of Sidney Buckman, who's one of the wonderful writer-producers from Hollywood, did the screenplay, and I thought it was extraordinary. I didn't know how he was able to take those eight lives and bring them into a cohesive whole.
Eight different women that went to school together.
Right, and make one movie out of it.
Uh-huh.
What year am I talking about?
You're talking about 1968.
The reason I ask is because Sidney had been blacklisted at one point. In fact, he was the vice president of Columbia Pictures and was thrown out during the McCarthy time. And this was him coming back to work. And I loved him. He was an amazing man, gentle, the best kind of ego, because he didn't want to be right. And it was a totally collaborative effort. I mean, we did everything together, the casting, the editing, everything. He was first rate. I felt that we never really got it. I thought we captured a wonderful spirit. Also, what interests me now in retrospect is that, in a way, it was the first movie that I'm aware of that had really to do with feminist issues. Work versus a child, mm-hmm. Bearing children. Every one of these, what started as girls and became women in the movie, were wrestling with the problem of what they wanted out of their lives versus what society relegated them to.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think that we really dramatized it enough. I think in a way, Sidney was totally faithful to the book, and in a way I think that hurt it. But it's still a very alive picture, and it's a lot of good things in it. Shirley Knight's performance is just wonderful.
She's sensational. Wonderful actress.
Yeah.
And Candace Bergen has certainly launched her in
it sure did.
Films big
also
time.
With a terrific
yeah.
performance.